childhood. He's angry for whatever reason. He wants something from us. We could send him out the caviar, but we don't like him. So we'll give him drinks, and I'm going to let you be the hero.
I'd rather not go over there again, Adrian said. Spillman can do it. Spillman had already walked away. Adrian watched him present the bottle to Duncan at the bar. Thatcher took Adrian's shoulder and wheeled her toward the dining room.
I'm going to let you be the hero, he said. Old-fashioned service. You said you knew all about it.
Adrian straightened the seams of her dress and tried to straighten out her frame of mind as she headed to table 12. She put her hand on the back of Dana's wicker chair. She couldn't bring herself to touch him, and she wasn't sure she was supposed to.
We're sorry about the bottle of wine, she said. We'd like to buy you a round of drinks on the house.
Lovely, the woman in lavender glasses murmured. For the first time, Adrian noticed the other couple at the table. They were in their 50s, distinguished-looking, Asian.
Thank you, the Asian man said, dipping his head at Adrian.
But Adrian was waiting to hear from the man named Dana. She was the hero, and she wanted him to acknowledge as much. He said nothing, and after a second, Adrian realized that he was one of those people who didn't have anything to offer unless he was angry or upset. He deserved an old-fashioned kick in the balls. In two seatings, only one person ate at the bar, a man in his mid-30s who wore a red sailcloth shirt over a white T-shirt. He smiled at Adrian every time she passed by. Red Shirt chatted with Duncan and drank a glass of whale's tail pale ale. Then a huge portion of chips and dip came out, so the guy was a VIP. He was wearing jeans and driving moccasins. He had brown hair receding a very little bit and nice brown eyes. He looked kind and responsible. No flashy good looks, no whiff of creepy lying bastard. Rule 3. Exercise good judgment about men. Red Shirt's appetizer was the beet salad. Adrian liked men who weren't afraid to order a salad. When she wandered up to the bar to have her champagne glass refilled, she actually bent her leg at the knee to show off her new shoes. Rex played Waltzing Matilda, and Adrian said to no one in particular, "Oh, I love this song." Duncan introduced Red Shirt to Delilah, but Adrian didn't catch his name.
"Introduce me," she thought.
Adrian ran appetizers for Joe. She retrieved 3 bottles of wine from the wine cave. She replaced the toilet paper in the ladies' room. She delivered 2 checks and got a lesson on the credit card machine from Thatcher. When she found a second to float by the bar again, Red Shirt was eating the lobster club, the entree Adrian herself most wanted to try. She approached Thatcher at the podium.
9 bottles of Laurent Perrier tonight, he said. Our experiment is really working. I still have to teach you how to use the wine key. When you can open wine, that will free me up. And champagne. There's a nice, quiet way to open champagne. I'll show you.
Who's that sitting at the bar? She asked. Thatcher didn't even look up.
Jasper Zotel.
Jasper Zotel?
J-Z. He drives the delivery truck. He comes every morning at 10.
Will you introduce me?
No.
Why not? Conveniently, the phone rang. The phone had been ringing all night. Half were reservation calls, half were inquiries about the bar. Was tonight, as rumor had it, first night of bar? This call was about the bar.
The bar is open tonight until 1, Thatcher said.
When he hung up, Adrian said, I heard about this huge bar scene. I heard about you hiring a bouncer and a line out into the parking lot. And yet the only person at the bar is the delivery driver, who is so undesirable, you won't even introduce me.
He is not undesirable, Thatcher said. He's a very nice guy. As for the bar, you just wait. Wait and see.
Adrian would have been just as happy if nobody had shown up. At the end of the second seating, there was a problem with one of the guests' credit cards. She ran it, and ran it, and each time the machine informed her that the card was unacceptable. But Adrian wasn't about to tell the guest this, when she had only learned the credit card machine that night, and it could just as easily have been she who was unacceptable. So she kept Joe waiting, as well as the guests, who had told Adrian that they wanted to get home and pay the babysitter. She didn't take the problem to Thatcher, primarily because she thought it was time she worked through a crisis by herself, but also because he had refused to introduce her to Jay-Z. Joe, whom Adrian had initially characterized as heavyset, now just seemed big and soft and rather handsome, his skin a chocolatey brown, distinct from the deep-fried russet color of the Subiacos. But even Joe, so polite and gentlemanly, had his limits. He glared at her as she ran the card again, punching the numbers in one by one. "What the fuck is taking so long?" he said. Adrian brandished the card. "It's no good. I run the card 6 times, 3 times manually, and I can't get a bite. You're going to have to tell them."
"And jeopardize my tip? No way, sister. You tell them."
Adrian peered over Joe's shoulder at the table. The lovely dark-haired wife was sitting sideways in her chair. She was all wrapped up in her pashmina like a present, her Louis Vuitton clutch purse in her lap. The husband had his pen poised. There would be no lengthy calculations with the tip, 40, 50, a nice round number on the generous side, a dashed-off signature, and these people were out the door. "Okay, I'll tell them," she said. Joe studied the card.
"Tell them it's expired," he said. "This card expired in May. Today is the 2nd of June. Didn't Thatch tell you to check the expiration first thing?"
Of course he had. Adrian hurried the card back over to the couple, explained the problem, and the man, with apologies, offered her an identical card with a different expiration, and Adrian ran it without incident. 60 seconds later, the couple was breezing past her with a happy, rushed wave. Thatcher, in the meantime, had asked Joe what the problem was. He had seen Joe and Adrian conferring by the credit card machine as he chatted with one of the fondue tables out in the sand, and Joe had tattled. Thatcher handed Adrian another leather folder.
"Run this, and always remember to check the expiration. I'm surprised you didn't learn that on your 5 front desks.
She wanted to tell him to go to hell. But she would be satisfied if nobody showed up for first night of bar, if the place didn't turn out to be as wildly popular as Thatcher and Duncan and Bon Appetit thought it was. Plus, she was tired again tonight. She'd had 2 glasses of champagne, 2 glasses of water, and a regular coffee loaded with cream and sugar. As the guests from second seating finished up and wandered toward the door, Adrian stood at the podium and bid them goodbye, hoping nobody could tell that the podium was holding her up. Jay-Z rose from the bar. He had finished his meal with Mario's ethereal candy plate, and Adrian thought he, too, was leaving. But he walked wide of the podium like he was headed for the men's room, except he bypassed the men's room and pushed open the door of the kitchen. The kitchen. Adrian stared at the swinging door with dread. What had Thatcher said? No guests allowed in the kitchen. Adrian waited a second to see if Jay-Z would come flying out on his butt. She stopped Karen. That guy who was sitting at the bar, did you see him? He went into the kitchen. I didn't realize that's where... Is that okay?
Who, Jay-Z? Karen said.
Yeah.
Well, you know who he is, right?
The delivery driver? Adrian said. Karen laughed and pushed into the kitchen behind him. And then, just when the restaurant was beginning to take on a sense of calm, Tyler, Roy, and Gage, the only flurry of activity as they cleared tables and stripped them, the headlights started pulling into the parking lot. The first people to reach the door were 4 large college boys wearing Oxford shirts over tie-dye and loafers from L.L. Bean. One of them had a black cord at the neck like Duncan's, only this cord had a purplish bead on it. From Connecticut, Adrian thought. Listen to Fish.
Bar open?
the one with the necklace asked, and Adrian surveyed the bar. Its four bar stools were deserted, and Duncan was checking over his bottles while Delilah worked around him, replacing glasses. Adrian held up a finger.
Boys like this. Boys like the ones she used to date at the three colleges she attended.
Perry Russell, junior year at Vanderbilt from Connecticut, listened to Fish, now made her feel old and prim.
Like a librarian.
She went over to check with Duncan. Thatcher was MIA. Is the bar open? This was possibly the dumbest question of all time. Why would tonight be called First Night of Bar if the bar wasn't open? But Duncan simply straightened his tie, squared his shoulders, punched a button on the CD player, REM's I Am Superman, and said,
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
It was nearing 11 o'clock. The four boys shook hands with Duncan, claimed the bar stools with a whoop, and ordered 888 and tonics. Adrian returned to the podium. A couple on a date came in, followed by a group of six women who called themselves the Whiners, followed by two older men who informed Adrian of her loveliness and told her they'd just finished an exquisite meal at Company of the Cauldron and wanted a nightcap. More women, a bachelorette party, the return of the local author and her entourage. By 10 after 11, Adrian couldn't even see Duncan through the throng of people. He turned up the stereo, and the floorboards vibrated under Adrian's shoes. Headlights continued to pull into the parking lot. Where, exactly, was Thatcher? Karen and Spillman still had tables out in the sand finishing dessert, but the other waiters would be cashing out. Adrian found Thatcher doling out tips from the cash box at a small deuce in the far corner of the restaurant. People keep pulling in, Adrian said. Where's the bouncer?
I was kidding about the bouncer, Thatcher said. Go back up front. When Duncan gives you the cutthroat sign, start your line. And then it's one for one. One person goes out, one person comes in.
Adrian rubbed her forehead. Really, could the man irritate her more? And headed back by the bar.
Adrian!
It was Duncan, holding aloft a glass of Lauren Perrier. Only 2 days earlier, good French champagne had been her favorite indulgence. But now, it held all the appeal of a glass of hemlock. Still, the guests at the bar parted for her like she was someone important. Thus, she felt compelled to take the glass and shout, "Thank you!" over the strains of an old Yaz tune. Duncan smiled and gave her the cutthroat sign. She carried her champagne to the podium just as two women stepped through the door. They were wearing black dresses and high heels. One woman was blonde, the other brunette. They looked to be in their 40s. Divorced, Adrian guessed. Out on the prowl. I'm sorry, Adrian said. The brunette flicked her eyes at Adrian, but didn't acknowledge her. The women kept walking.
Excuse me, Adrian called.
She put her glass down and took a few strides toward the women until she was able to reach out and touch the middle of the brunette's bare back. That did it. The brunette spun around.
What?
How predictable was this? I was kidding about the bouncer. What Thatcher meant was, you, Adrian, are the bouncer. The bar's full, Adrian said. You'll have to wait by the door until someone leaves. The brunette might have been beautiful at one time, but it looked like she'd gotten in a lot of afternoons at the beach over the years without sunscreen. That and something else. When her brow creased at Adrian's words, she looked like a witch. It was probably the face she used to scare her children.
We're friends of Cat, she said.
Friends of Cat, the electrician. Cat, who was the most important VIP in the unlikely event of a blackout.
Okay, Adrian said, but she didn't smile because she wasn't that much of a pushover.
A minute later, Karen appeared. Duncan's pissed. Adrian blinked. Duncan had every right to be pissed. He'd given her the cutthroat sign, and not 30 seconds later, she let in more people. But Adrian did not like being confronted by Karen in her new capacity as Duncan's girlfriend.
They said they were friends of Kat.
Everyone on the island is friends with Kat, Karen said.
If that bar gets any heavier, it's going to sink into the sand.
But more importantly, if you let any more people in, you're going to ruin it for the people who are already here.
I understand that, Adrian said tersely. Thatcher just left me here to bounce.
Karen shrugged and reached for her hair. With the release of one pin, it all came tumbling down.
Are you going home? Adrian asked.
And miss first night of bar? Karen said. No way.
Do you want to help me keep the masses at bay?
No, Karen said. I'm going to change.
As she left, more headlights materialized. Adrian tightened the muscles in her face. Nobody else was getting past. The next people to approach were another couple on a date. The girl wore a cute sequin dress that Adrian had seen at Gypsy but couldn't afford.
Sorry, Adrian told them, and she did, to her own ears, sound genuinely sorry.
You'll have to wait.
Like magic.
They obeyed, staying right in front of the podium. Turned out, the couple was used to standing in line here. And once this couple formed a willing start to the line, everyone who came after had no choice but to follow suit. In 10 minutes, Adrian had a line a dozen people long. She felt a brand new emotion, the surge of pure power. She was the gatekeeper. At one point, a man with wet-looking black hair and a chain with a gold marijuana leaf dangling from it swaggered toward her, nudging aside the couple on a date.
"I'm a friend of Duncan's," he said.
"Everyone's a friend of Duncan's," she said, and she sent him to the end of the line.
Finally, Thatcher came sauntering up with the cash box under his arm and a wad of paper-clipped receipts.
"How's everything going?"
he asked.
"Fine," Adrian said.
"Is the line moving?"
"No."
"No," he said. "It never does."
"So some people stay in this line until closing?"
"Oh, sure," he said.
He smiled at the adorable couple on their date, and Adrian could tell he recognized them, but didn't remember their names.
"Eat," she said.
She felt wonderful saying this.
She knew better than to count on him.
It was midnight. Only 1 hour left of this madness. As Thatcher walked into the kitchen, Jay-Z emerged. They exchanged a few quiet words. Adrian was so keenly interested in what they were saying that it took her a moment to notice the author and her entourage on their way out.
"We're going to the chicken box," the author said. "Want me to count off 8 heads for you?"
"Please,"
Adrian said. So her line was less by 8. Adrian was happy to see the young couple make it in, but there were still a dozen people in her line, and now the person at the front was the wet-haired friend of Duncan. He glared at Adrian in such an overtly malicious way that she considered asking him why he was wearing a marijuana leaf around his neck.
Did he want people to know he smoked pot? Did he think it would encourage interest from the right kind of women?
Her thoughts were interrupted when Jay-Z handed her a basket of crackers.
"Thank you," Adrian said. "Thank you.
Thank you." "I'm Jay-Z," he said.
Adrian held out her hand. "Adrian Dealey, the new assistant manager."
"I know. Fiona told me."
Adrian tasted a cracker. They were a different kind tonight, cheddar with sesame seeds.
Scrumptious.
Wet Hair watched her eat the cracker with envy, and Adrian hoped he was hungry. She hoped that all he'd had for dinner were fries from Stubby's on the strip by Steamboat Wharf.
"What did Fiona say?" Adrian asked Jay-Z.
"That the gorgeous brunette by the front door was Adrian Dealey, the new assistant manager."
At this point, Wet Hair, who had been eavesdropping, felt entitled to join the conversation.
"I had a feeling you were new," he said. "Otherwise, you would have let me in."
Adrian ignored him.
"Did Fiona actually call me a gorgeous brunette?"
No, Jay-Z said. I did. He pointed to the basket of crackers. Please help yourself. I have to make the rounds with these, then get out of here. I have a buddy at the airport waiting to fly me home.
Fly you home?
I live on the Cape. Normally I take the boat back and forth every day.
That's quite a commute.
Lots of people do it, he said. I sleep on the boat, and it pays the bills. Listen, it was nice meeting you.
Adrian was so crestfallen he was leaving that even the pile of crackers didn't cheer her. She stacked them on the podium like so many gold coins. She watched Jay-Z pass the basket to Delilah, the busboys, and Joe, who was left with a single cracker. Then Jay-Z said goodbye to a bunch of people at the bar and headed for the door. He waved to Adrian on his way out. Bye, she said.
Wet Hair roused Adrian from her reverie by tapping her arm.
He left, right? So I can go in?
No, she said.
Somehow she got drunk. To avoid further conversation with Wet Hair, Adrian concentrated on her crackers, and her crackers made her thirsty. So she drank her champagne. Someone in the bachelorette party decided to buy every woman in the restaurant a shot called Prairie Fire, which was a lethal combination of tequila and Tabasco. This same woman convinced Duncan to play It's Raining Men at top decibel and further convinced him to allow the bride-to-be to dance on the blue granite in her bare feet. Adrian watched all this from the safety of the podium, thinking about how much more she would enjoy these shenanigans if she didn't have Wet Hair breathing into the side of her face. Then Karen appeared, wearing a black halter top that showed off her perfectly flat, perfectly tanned stomach, and a pair of low-slung white jeans. She was dressed like a 20-year-old, but she looked better than any 20-year-old could ever hope to. Adrian suddenly felt dowdy. Here she was in Chloe and Dolce & Gabbana in an attempt to get away from the kid stuff. Karen held out a shot glass, Adrian's Prairie Fire, because she did, after all, qualify as a woman in the restaurant.
Come on, Karen said. Let's do them together.
Adrian accepted the shot glass. Well, it was better than espresso. They did the shots, and Karen offered Adrian a swig from her beer as a chaser. Adrian's throat burned, her eyes watered. The bride-to-be was doing the twist on the bar, every man in the place looking up her Lily Pulitzer skirt. Then Karen screamed, Charlie! She hugged the man with the wet hair. He threw Adrian a look of enormous satisfaction and contempt over Karen's shoulder. Adrian felt no remorse, only distaste that Karen should actually know this person.
This is Charlie, Karen explained. A friend of Duncan's. He doesn't have to wait.
Adrian was just as happy to have Wet Hair leave her proximity.
Go, she said. The tequila and Tabasco had warmed her mood. Enjoy.
The new head of the line was a kid who looked about 12. He was short and had acne around his nose.
Do I have to card? Adrian wondered.
She wasn't going to card. Her job was pure mathematics, one out, one in. She heard a deep, metallic thrum. It sounded like a gong. Adrian looked to the bar to see Duncan holding an enormous handbell, the kind used in church choirs.
Last call, he shouted.
Last call. Music to her ears. Paco wandered past the podium, still in his chef's whites, and Adrian yelled out to him. She pulled a $50 bill out of her change purse, which was stashed inside the podium. You've been a big help, she said.
Thank you.
She pressed the bill into Paco's hand.
Thank you, Paco said. You want me to get you a drink?
Yes, Adrian said, surveying the dancing, pulsing crowd. Two. She should have gone home when the restaurant closed. It was very late. But Karen told her about a party at the Subiaco house in Surfside. Practically the whole staff was going, and Karen felt that Adrian should go, too.
To prove you're one of the gang, she said.
Adrian agreed to go with Karen and Duncan in Karen's Jetta,
she would stay for one drink, then call a cab and be home in bed by 3 o'clock at the very latest. It wasn't until Adrian was already ensconced in the back seat of the car that she realized Wet Hair Charlie was coming with them. The opposite door opened and he climbed in. Adrian's enthusiasm flagged.
I don't know about this, Adrian said. It's getting late.
I figured you for a stick in the mud, Charlie said.
Come on, Karen said. It'll be fun. During the ride, Charlie pulled out a joint, lit up, and passed it around.
Adrian refused, then cracked her window. This was what she'd always thought the restaurant life would be like.
2 o'clock in the morning, doing drugs on her way to a party, where she would proceed to drink even more than she had drunk during her 8-hour shift. She laughed, and then Charlie laughed, though he had no idea what was funny. The Subiaco house was huge and funky. It had curved steps that led up to a grand front porch with a swing. The house had diamond-shaped windows, some panes of stained glass, and a turret. Inside, though, it was a bad marriage of down-at-the-heels beach cottage and urban bachelor pad. In the first living room Adrian entered, the furniture was upholstered in faded, demure prints. There was a rocking chair and a few ding tables. There was a second living room with a cracked leather sofa and a state-of-the-art entertainment system. Flat-screen TV on the wall, surround sound, stereo thumping with 10-year-old rap. Adrian couldn't stand the noise. She headed out to the sun porch, where there was wicker furniture and an old piano. She took a seat on the piano bench. Karen appeared, bearing two bright red drinks, and she handed one to Adrian.
What's this? Adrian asked.
I don't know, Karen admitted.
Adrian took a sip. It tasted like a mixture of Kool-Aid and lighter fluid. She put the drink down on the piano.
Duncan didn't make this?
No, Karen said.
It was in a punch bowl on the kitchen table.
They're trying to poison us so they can take our money, Adrian said. She had left her change purse with $300 in it in Karen's car.
Duncan came onto the sun porch, and he and Karen settled down on the wicker sofa. Then Charlie walked in, and after looking around the room, no doubt hoping for better company, he plopped down on the piano bench next to Adrian. That was all she needed.
I'm getting out of here, she said.
Stay, Karen said. It's fun.
Stick in the mud, Charlie said.
Adrian peeked into the next room. Elliot, Christo, and a few of the unidentified Subiacos were smoking cigarettes watching Apocalypse Now to a soundtrack of Dr. Dre.
Fun?
In the kitchen, Tyler and Roy, the most definitely underage busboys, were doing shots of Jägermeister. Adrian thought she might get sick just watching them. Phone, she said. They pointed down the hall. She located a wobbly pie-crust table where the last rotary phone in America rested on a crocheted doily. Adrian called A1 Taxi, but was unable to give them her exact location.
Out by the airport, she said.
Surfside? It's a big house at the end of a dirt road, the Subiaco house.
Subiaco? The cab driver said. I'll be there in 20 minutes.
Okay, Adrian said. She went outside to retrieve her change purse from Karen's car and decided to wait for the cab on the bottom step of the porch. Then she heard someone whisper her name. She turned around. Mario was lying on the porch swing, drinking a beer.
What are you doing here? He asked.
I came to the party, she said, wondering if because she was a manager, this would sound weird. She climbed the steps to the porch and leaned back against the railing, checking it first to make sure it wouldn't give way, dumping her into the bushes. But I have to go home. I'm tired.
You can sleep upstairs with me, he said.
No, thanks, she said. I've been warned about you.
Oh, really?
The king of the sweet ending?
Mario laughed. Please, he said. Just call me king.
He drained his beer, then sat up. He wore jeans and a black t-shirt.
There was something about him, Adrian thought. He emanated heat, smoldered, like all the other womanizers she had ever known. How'd you get that scar on your neck? Adrian asked.
Pulling a cookie sheet out of a high oven, he said, a million years ago in culinary school.
You went to school with Fiona?
Met her in Skills 1, he said. It was a very tough class. We bonded.
He laughed.
She's a big hotshot now, but when I first met her, she couldn't even carry a tray of veal bones, okay? We had to roast 50 pounds a day for stock, and that's more than half Fee's body weight. Our instructor did a double take when he saw her. He was like, "How did a fourth grader get into our classroom?"
Adrian turned around to search the darkness for the lights of her cab. It felt dangerous to be talking about Fiona like this, though, of course, Adrian was enthralled. Was cooking school tough?
Killer, he said.
He patted the spot next to him on the swing.
Sit here. I'll tell you all about it.
I'm fine, Adrian said.
You got that right, Mario said. If you're wondering how an inner-city Cuban schlub like me got into the CIA, the answer is, I'm a minority.
He laughed again.
And a fucking genius, of course.
Adrian tried to smile, but she was too tired. She checked behind her. Nothing.
I'm only kidding, Mario sang out. My whole family works in kitchens. My old man and his three brothers worked in the line at the Palmer House in Chicago, and all the brothers had sons. There are 11 of us all together, and we all work in kitchens. My brother Luis was a prep cook at Charlie Trotter. Hector worked at Mango. Eddie flipped eggs at the North Side. I worked at so many places, I can't even remember them all. But after high school, I got tired of making $5 an hour. I wanted to learn technique, so off I go to the best cooking school in the country, and it kicked my ass. I nearly quit.
Really?
I hated the hotline, hated it. Now, Fiona, she loved the hotline. The hotter and the busier it was, the more she liked it. The other guys worshipped her. Tiny little thing like that couldn't even get the veal bones from the oven to the counter. And here she is, doing 80 plates an hour, swearing like a sailor. She was the one who told me I belonged in pastry, but you know what I thought? Pastry is for chicks. So I got a big, brawny externship at the pump room back home, and that made school look like Sesame Street. When I went back to the CIA and tried pastry, I realized there's worse things in life than being in a room full of chicks.
I guess so.
You like dessert?
Of course I like dessert.
Everybody likes dessert, Mario said. And pastry is cool, okay? It's quiet. It's solitary. It's a place where you have the time and space to lavish the ingredients with love. I'm all about the love.
He made the word love sound like a big, soft bed she could fall into. Adrian gripped the railing. Rule 3. She took a big drink of night air. It was absurdly late. She checked the gravel driveway and the dirt road again. She couldn't tell if the glow in the distance were headlights or lights from the airport.
"So you brought everybody here?" Adrian said. "All your cousins."
3 stayed back home, Mario said. My brother Mikey is a lawyer, and Hector's twin brothers, Phil and Petey, didn't want to leave Chicago. They work together at the hottest sushi place in the city and have season tickets to the Bulls, so...
So, Adrian said, what will you do next year when the restaurant is closed?
Cry my eyes out, Mario said. But it's far from over. We have a long summer ahead.
Yeah, Adrian said. It was going to be a very long summer if she didn't get any sleep. Her head felt like it was filled with dried beans, but then she saw headlights, actual, true headlights, and even better, the bright top hat of a taxi.
The cab stopped in front of the house, and the door popped open.
"Hey, everybody!" a voice called out.
It was Delilah. She was, inexplicably, wearing a belly dancer costume, a red satin bra, and transparent harem pants. She ran up the steps, dinging finger cymbals. Adrian hurried past her before the cab drove off. As she pulled away, Adrian gazed back at the house in time to see Mario, ever the gentleman, leading Delilah inside. 2. Dr. Don at toothache.com. From Addie12177@hotmail.com. Date, June 7th, 2005, 8:37 a.m. Subject, see and be seen. At first, I thought the bistro was all about the food, but after a week of work, I can tell you, it's all about the drinks. It's a huge scene. Some nights, it's like a fraternity party, and some nights, it's something else entirely. Think of a dozen women in for a 50th birthday party belting out New York, New York, while doing chorus line kicks. Last night, I let a man into the bar, and he tipped me $500. I told him I couldn't possibly accept it, and he said,
"Do you want me to give it to the bartender instead?"
So I put it in an envelope and mailed it off to you this morning. Only $500 to go. I never considered myself a night owl, but since I started work, I haven't gotten to bed before 2. I sleep until at least 8, then take a nap on the beach. I haven't gone jogging even once, but I am brushing and flossing and doing my best to stay away from the candy plate. How are the smiles in Maryland? Love. 2. Addie12177@hotmail.com. From Dr. Don@toothache.com. Date, June 7th, 2005, 8:45 a.m. Subject, nobody knows the troubles I've seen. I'm not sure how I'm supposed to handle being the father of the doyen of Nantucket nightlife. Should I be worried or proud or both? Mavis says she wants to visit Nantucket. I know I always promise and never come, but this time I think we might. Can you research some B&Bs and book us a night at your restaurant, of course? I'd love to see my little girl in action. Love, love. 2. Dr. Don at toothache.com. From Addie12177@hotmail.com. Date, June 7th, 2005, 8:52 a.m. Subject, don't book 'em yet, Dono. Let me get my sea legs before you show up, okay? Promise me you won't book anything without double, triple checking with me first. 2. Addie12177@hotmail.com. From Dr. Don@toothache.com. Date, June 7th, 2005, 8:59 a.m. Subject, I promise. Love, love, love. To Kira Crenshaw at Mindspring.com. From Addie12177@hotmail.com. Date, June 7th, 2005, 9:04 a.m. Subject, sex, drugs, and lobster roll. Duncan has spent every night here for the past 9 nights. They always look so tuckered out in the morning. Thank God the walls are thick. Karen thinks it's this big secret, but one of the other waiters at work said he was pretty sure the only reason Duncan shacked up here was because he doesn't want to sleep in the same apartment with his sister. I, of course, pretended like I didn't know what he was talking about. Aspen seems like a million years ago. I haven't thought about Doug in weeks. I miss you, though. How's Carmel? Seen Clint Eastwood?
Chapter 4. Reservations. Adrian wasn't sure how long her father's affair with Mavis had been going on. When he set up his dental practice in 1984, the office had three employees: Adrian's father, whom everyone called Dr. Don, Adrian's mother, Rosalie, who worked the reception desk, booked appointments, and did all the billing, and Mavis, the hygienist. 5 years later, when Adrian's mother got sick, Adrian was old enough to fill in for her mother after school and on Saturdays, and to work during the week, they had hired a retired woman named Mrs. Leach. But there had always been Mavis, with her blonde Dorothy Hamill haircut, her smell of antiseptic soap, and the juicy fruit gum that she chewed to freshen her breath after lunch, despite Dr. Don's fatwa on chewing gum of any kind. When she was first hired, Mavis was a single mother with 3-year-old twin boys named Coleman and Graham, who was deaf. Mavis's husband had left her, and Mavis's family lived in the French part of Louisiana, which she described as a stinking swamp. She had no desire to return. Adrian's parents took pity on Mavis, especially Adrian's mother, who was prone to fits of do-gooding. As a happy coincidence, it turned out that Mavis was a talented hygienist. She had a light touch, a southern accent, and because she dealt on a daily basis with her deaf son, she took great pains to make her communications with children gentle and clear. How many times had Adrian heard her go through the brushing spiel? "Now I'm gonna put a little bit of paste on the brush. See, it tastes like bubble gum. Don't tell the doctor. The brush is gonna move in really fast circles, so it might tickle a bit. You're laughing already. I can't believe it." It was impossible to think of Mavis without thinking of Rosalie, not only because Rosalie and Mavis were best friends, but also because as Rosalie's presence in Adrian's life waned, Mavis's increased. Rosalie's illness came on very strong and suddenly. There might have been a clue in the fact that Rosalie had lost her first child in a hard labor, and after Adrian, Dr. Don and Rosalie had not been able to conceive another child. But Rosalie's outlook was that some people were blessed with many children, and some with only one. And she reveled in the fact that her one child was as well-adjusted and delightful as Adrian. Then when Adrian was 11, going on 12, and was, at that age, neither well-adjusted nor delightful, Rosalie started having pains. She went to her gynecologist and came home looking like she had seen a ghost. A biopsy a week later at the hospital of the University of Pennsylvania had diagnosed her with inoperable ovarian cancer and 4 to 6 months to live. Adrian knew these details now, as an adult, but at the time she had not been well informed. Her father, a graduate of the dental school at Penn, was friends with the head of internal medicine at HUP, and Adrian was aware of her father's conversations with him and other doctors at the hospital. Initially, she thought it was Dr. Don who was sick, because it was he who looked like he might die. Eventually, both her parents sat her down and told her that Rosalie had cancer. It was Mavis's idea to send Adrian to Camp Hideaway in the Pocono Mountains. Adrian didn't want to go. She claimed she wanted to help take care of her mother, but really, she didn't want to leave her friends, and she was addicted to General Hospital, and she knew from reading the brochure that Camp Hideaway didn't have a single TV. She begged her father to let her stay home, and when begging didn't work, she threatened him. She would run away. She would hitchhike. She would accept a ride with any stranger, even if it was a man with yellow teeth. Finally, Adrian appealed to her mother. Adrian knew her mother loved her to the point of distraction. Once, she had snooped through Rosalie's desk, where she found a tablet on which Rosalie had written Adrian's name 100 times, and in the middle of the page it said, "Unconditional love." When Adrian spoke to Rosalie about camp, Rosalie said, "Please do as your father says.
He and Mavis think it's for the best.
Rosalie's tone of voice was distant, as if she were already gone. Adrian went to Camp Hideaway for 6 weeks, and when Adrian looked back on her life, she could say that she went to Camp Hideaway as one kind of person and left as another. Her first day at camp was up and down. The cabin was musty. Her top bunk stared right into the cobwebby rafters. Her cabin mates were all scrawny and knew nothing about puberty. The bathhouse smelled like a chemical toilet. The water at the fountain tasted like rust, and the dining hall served stale potato chips. However, things improved during taps, the flag lowering, and the campfire, where one very cute male counselor played the guitar. There was the promise of swimming the next day, and canoeing and a scavenger hunt. After lights out, in the dark, musty cabin, where some of her cabin mates were actually crying, Adrian started telling lies. She told the 12 girls she had just met that she had been sent to camp because her brother was dying. Maybe she had meant to say mother, but she didn't. She said, very distinctly, brother. And the girls were hooked. Adrian felt bad almost immediately and wished that she could retract the claim or amend it, but there was no way to do so without being labeled a fake, a liar, person to be gossiped about for the next 6 weeks. She told herself it wasn't a complete lie because Adrian had had a brother once upon a time. Her mother had delivered a stillborn baby 3 years before Adrian, a baby named Jonathan. Adrian had wondered for years about Jonathan and what he had looked like and whether or not he was technically her brother if he had died before she was even born. She wondered why Jonathan's name hadn't been on her mother's tablet with the words, unconditional love. When the girls in her cabin asked what her dying brother's name was, she told them, and saying it out loud had made him seem real. On the last night of camp, Adrian confessed the truth to Pammy Ip. By this time, Adrian and Pammy were such good friends that Adrian wanted to set the record straight. It wasn't her brother who was dying. In fact, she had no brother. It was her mother who was dying. Pammy Ip had looked nonplussed.
"Why didn't you just tell us that in the first place?" she said.
When Adrian walked into her mother's hospital room upon her return home, she gagged. All of Rosalie's hair was gone. She looked like a health class skeleton, a space alien. The worst thing was that Rosalie seemed to know how hideous she looked, and she told Adrian that she didn't have to visit the hospital again if she didn't want to. Didn't have to visit her own sick mother? Adrian went home and cried. She was plagued by confusion and guilt. Why had she lied to her camp friends? Why had she bothered telling Pammy Ip the truth at the last minute? Pammy hadn't said a proper goodbye that final morning, and Adrian had seen her whispering with the other girls, telling them, probably. Adrian had lied, and her mother was getting worse, not better, and Adrian felt responsible. She begged her father to take her to the hospital every day. Rosalie wore headscarves or an old Phillies baseball cap. She and Adrian drank Pepsi and watched General Hospital, and they talked about Adrian's friends at school. They did not talk about death or even love until the very end. Rosalie made it clear that the worst thing about dying would be leaving Adrian behind without a mother. Adrian wanted to ask her mother about the tablet she found. She wanted to ask about Jonathan. And most of all, she wanted to confess to the insidious lies of the summer. But she didn't want to upset her mother or make her sicker. And then, the night before Adrian was supposed to start 7th grade, Rosalie fell into a coma and died. It was at the reception following the funeral that Adrian decided to hate Mavis. Mavis called the school to say Adrian wouldn't be starting for 2 weeks. Mavis made the tea sandwiches and her mother's favorite asparagus roll-ups. Mavis kept her arm around Adrian's shoulders and steered her toward this person and that person who wanted to express their condolences. In the days following, Mavis prodded Adrian to write thank you notes for flowers and food. Despite these things, or perhaps because of these things, Mavis became the enemy. Adrian was relieved, happy even, when a few weeks later, her father told her they were moving to Maine. Adrian wanted to leave. The town where she lived had become a minefield. Here was the road where Rosalie once got a speeding ticket. Here was the expressway that led to the hospital. Here was the cemetery where Rosalie was now buried. Adrian wanted to leave her friends who barely understood what had happened, and her teachers who fully understood and treated Adrian so gingerly, it was as though she was the one with the disease. But most of all, Adrian wanted to leave Mavis. They sold their house and moved to Maine at the beginning of November. By Christmas, Adrian's father still hadn't hired a hygienist. He was doing every single cleaning himself, and it was too much. Finally, he hired a young girl named Curry Jones, who had just finished her hygiene courses. Because she was brand new, Dr. Don figured he could train her to work just like Mavis. Curry Jones was a pretty girl with a permanent scowl. During every cleaning, she dug the probe into the patient's soft pink gums until blood sprang to the surface. Don fired her after 2 weeks. He called Mavis in Philadelphia. He helped her find a school that would take Graham, and she relocated. The first thing she said to Adrian upon arriving in the new office was,
"I couldn't stand to think of your father working with that sadist."
That, Adrian later realized, was probably when the affair started, less than 6 months after Rosalie's death. Adrian was 13 and the twins were 8. Adrian was called on time and time again to babysit for them while her father and Mavis worked late. Adrian had actually learned the alphabet and sign language. Mavis followed them 3 years later to Iowa and 18 months after that to Louisville, Kentucky. Dr. Don was a good dentist, and he was respected and well-loved in each of his practices, but he didn't have staying power. Before this last move to the Eastern Shore, he tried to explain it to Adrian over the phone. He couldn't bear to have any place become his home.
"My home was with Rosalie," he said.
One thing Adrian felt glad about was that even though Don and Mavis had now been together longer than Don and Rosalie, Don did not refer to Mavis as his home. He still loved Adrian's mother. He would always love her. Adrian didn't fault her father for his peripatetic nature. Since graduating from high school, Adrian hadn't stayed anywhere for more than 2 years. She couldn't count the number of times she had been asked, "Where's your home?" And when she couldn't provide an answer, the well-intentioned soul might ask, "Where does your mother live?" Even at 28 years old, home was where her mother lived. Everywhere. Nowhere. Adrian was still in her pajamas, reading and rereading the email from her father and worrying prematurely about a visit from him and Mavis when the phone rang. Adrian had heard the growl of the espresso machine a few minutes earlier, and so she knew Karen, and probably Duncan, were awake. The ringing stopped, and Karen tapped on the door with her fingernails. She cracked the door and handed in the phone. "It's for you," she said. "It's Thatch." Adrian stared at the phone. She had yet to tell Thatcher the truth about her mother. She wanted to tell him, but with all that was happening at the restaurant, there was never a good time. He was going to think she was a mental case. "Hello?" she said.
"Can you come in?" Thatcher asked. "I know it's short notice, but I have reconfirmation calls from 10 to noon, and I forgot I'm supposed to meet with my priest."
Adrian might have laughed, but a few nights earlier, a busy Saturday night, Thatcher and Fiona had both been an hour late because they attended 5 o'clock Mass at St. Mary's. His meeting with a priest seemed to follow in this vein. "I was there until 2 last night," she said, "and I was hoping to go to the beach today."
"I'll pay you," Thatcher said. "Obviously."
I'll have Fee make you lunch.
Adrian smiled into the phone, thinking, teeth, clothes, her 10-speed bike. I can be there in 15 minutes. According to her sports watch, it only took 12 minutes to make it to the fork in the road, but that wasn't fast enough. She saw Thatcher driving toward her in his silver pickup on his way into town.
Good you're here, he said,
though she was still 300 yards from the restaurant.
I left the book open for you with a list of people to call to reconfirm. It's easy. Just remind them of their time and the number in their party and note any changes, any special requests, birthdays, that kind of thing. Okay?
Adrian was dying to ask him why he was going to see a priest. What if someone calls for a reservation?
Write down the name and number and I'll call back after 12.
Adrian saluted, and Thatcher drove away. Adrian pedaled toward the bistro. It was another glorious day. Bright sunshine, crisp, clean sea air. She had worn her bikini under her clothes. After Thatcher returned, she was going to lie on the beach in front of the restaurant. Adrian had expected the restaurant to be deserted, but there were 5 cars and a big Sid Wainer truck in the parking lot. The delivery truck. Adrian's heart trilled at the thought of Jay-Z, whom she hadn't seen since the first night of bar. A second later, she caught a glimpse of him from the back, in uniform, engaged in a heated conversation. Adrian stopped her bike behind the car she knew to be Fiona's, a navy blue Range Rover with tinted windows. Though she heard Jay-Z's voice, she couldn't make out what he was saying. The back of his delivery truck was open, and in its dim interior, she spied crates of lemons and limes, long braids of garlic, cartons of eggs, and a wooden box stamped Haas Avocado, California. Adrian dismounted her bike and walked it closer to the front door. As she did, she heard one sentence very clearly. I love you so much, it's making me weak. And then she heard someone answer, It's not enough, Jay-Z. It will never be enough. Adrian knew it was Fiona. Of course, it was Fiona, but she had to get a visual. She peeked around the next closest car, Mario's red Durango. From there, she could see them. Jay-Z in his olive drab pants and white uniform shirt, and Fiona in cut-off jean shorts, a pale pink tank top, and pink leather clogs. Both of them looked anguished, close to tears, and then Fiona started to cough, a deep, racking cough that sounded like she was trying to dislodge a piece of concrete from her lungs. It caused her to bend at the waist, one hand bracing her knee, one hand covering her mouth. Jay-Z picked her up under her arms and pressed her tiny body against his. Fiona's clogs dropped from her feet. Adrian couldn't tear her eyes away. She could sense Fiona's lightness and Jay-Z's strength, their mutual sadness and rage. God, how long had it been since she felt that way about someone? Ever? Fiona continued to cough, her face hidden in Jay-Z's shirt. Adrian leaned her bike against the geranium-filled dory and proceeded inside. It was, quite possibly, the most heartbreaking embrace she had ever seen. The bistro looked different during the day. It seemed tired and exposed, like a lady of the evening roused from sleep the next morning without her makeup. The tables were bare and the white wicker chairs had been flipped upside down on top of them so that the cleaning crew could do the floors. But the cleaning crew hadn't arrived yet, and the floor was covered with dropped food and sticky puddles. Since she knew Fiona wasn't in the kitchen, Adrian poked her head in. Half the crew was at work prepping. Joe was making the mustard in a 12-quart stockpot. Adrian watched him for a minute, in awe of the sheer volume of ingredients. 1 pound of dry mustard, 5 cups of vinegar, 8 cups of sugar, 1 pound of butter, and 12 eggs. Joe added 16 grinds of white pepper from a pepper mill that was longer than his arm. Adrian blew Joe a kiss. Then she poked her head around the corner into pastry. Mario was rolling out dough. She watched him flour the marble counter and work a huge mass of dough with his Walkman on. When he saw her, he removed his headphones.
"What are you doing here?"
"Working," she said. "What are you making?"
"Pies," he said.
He checked his watch and wiped his brow on his shoulder.
"And I have two kinds of ice cream to make, and a batch of marshmallows, and lemon curd. And I have pineapple to roast, and the rolls. But I save those for last."
"You're in the weeds, then?" she asked.
"Never me, baby," he said.
Adrian wanted to ask him about Fiona and Jay-Z, but she was afraid that either he wouldn't tell her what she wanted to know, or else he would tell Fiona that she'd asked. So instead, Adrian said, "How's Delilah?" It came as no surprise to find out that, after the night of the harem pants and finger symbols, Mario and Delilah were having a fling.
"Oh, honey," he said.
He cut 20 perfect rounds out of the dough and draped them into doll-sized pie pans.
"What?" Adrian said. "You want me to tell you about the sex?"
"No," Adrian said.
"Then what did you ask about Delilah for?"
She was just making conversation. Anything so she could stay and watch Mario work. He moved the pie dough into the freezer and set a timer. Then he began the ice cream. He took a carton of 60 eggs from the walk-in and proceeded to separate the yolks from the whites by sifting the whites through his fingers.
"Some people think sugar is the key to desserts," Mario said. "But I am here to tell you that if you want a good dessert, you have to start with a fresh egg."
He held out his palm, displaying a whole perfect, bright orange yolk, which he slipped into his Hobart mixer.
"What do you do with the whites?" Adrian asked. "Throw them away?" "I use them in the marshmallows," he said. "Have you ever tasted one of my marshmallows?"
She shook her head. "Lighter than air," he said.
"I make the best marshmallows in the country. Maybe the world."
"Okay, Marshmallow King," she said. "I have to get to work." Mario replaced his headphones and separated another egg while doing the samba. Back in the kitchen, Hector was peeling and deveining shrimp with a tool that looked like a plastic dentist's probe. He had a mountain of shrimp on his left and a mountain on his right, uncleaned and cleaned. He tossed the shells into a stock pot.
"That's a lot of shrimp," Adrian said.
"Shrimp bisque," Hector said without looking up. "Shrimp toast, shrimp for fondue."
The oldest Subiaco, Antonio, a man with a mustache and gray hair around his ears, trimmed lamb. He worked so fast, Adrian feared he would cut himself, especially as he seemed intent on listening to what sounded like a baseball game being broadcast in Spanish on the Bose radio. The baseball game broke for commercial, and Antonio called out,
"Where's the steak?"
"It's still on the truck," somebody answered.
"Well, go get it, Luis." "No fucking way," Luis said. "They're out there fighting."
They're out there fighting. Adrian hung around for a beat to see if anyone would respond to this, but no one did, and Adrian took this as her cue to leave. As she stepped into the dining room, she bumped into Fiona. Fiona alone, her eyes pink and watery. She stopped when she saw Adrian and brushed an imaginary hair from her face.
"Thank you for covering the phones," Fiona said.
"I know I'm supposed to make you lunch, but I can't today. I have to get out of here for a while. I'll ask Antonio to do it. You know Antonio, he's my Sue."
Adrian smiled.
"Sure, whatever.
What would you like?"
"Anything," Adrian said.
"I don't mean to complicate your day." Fiona coughed, briefly, dryly, into her hand.
"Fine," she said. "Want anything? I'll have him bring it out to you in an hour or so."
Thatcher had left a list of 50 names and numbers, 18 reservations for first seating, 32 for second. About half the reservations were people staying at hotels and inns, 3 reservations from the beach club, 2 from the White Elephant, 2 from the Pineapple Inn. Next came a bunch of names that Adrian, after a week of work, recognized. Parrish, 6 o'clock, of course, it was Tuesday. Egan, Montero, Kennedy, No relation. Though Mr. Kennedy was one of the investors, and Adrian saw the word comp next to his name in the book. Jameson, Walker, and Lefroy. This last name was underlined and followed by 3 exclamation points, and Adrian realized that it was Tyler, the busboy's parents, his father, the health inspector. That's right, she remembered now. The cleaning crew was coming in late today so that everything had a better chance of staying spick and span. The staff was eating family meal out on the beach, picnic style. Sloppy Joe's, potato salad, and root beer handmade by Henry Subiaco, the sauté cook. If the root beer tasted good, Henry was going to try to market it next year when the restaurant was closed. Next year, when the restaurant was closed, Adrian might have finally figured out what was going on while the restaurant was open. She glanced up to see Fiona rush out the front door. Through the window, Adrian watched her climb, 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 Pammy Ip up the sycamore tree, into the cab of Jay-Z's truck. They were in love. Adrian felt victorious about this knowledge, despite the fact that she would now have to erase Jay-Z from her short list of possible men to date. The work Thatcher left seemed very straightforward. Taking reservations was another story. That involved the calculus of who fit where and what time, and, most crucially, at which table. Apparently some guests got their feelings hurt over where in the restaurant they sat, so this was Thatcher's department. Adrian called the first name on the list, Devlin. Next to the name Devlin, it said birthday, dessert candle, no chocolate. A woman picked up on the first ring. Hello? Good morning, Adrian said. Is this Mrs. Devlin?
Why, yes, it is.
The woman sounded both wary and hopeful, like maybe Adrian was calling from Publisher's Clearinghouse, and maybe she'd won something. This is Adrian calling from the Blue Bistro.
Yes,
more hopeful now than wary. Just calling to confirm your reservation tonight for a party of 6 at 6. It's somebody's birthday?
It's my birthday, she said. But I didn't know we had reservations at the bistro.
4-6 at 6, you say?
I hope we're not bringing the kids.
Maybe you'd better talk to my husband, Brian. He's right here. During the switch of the phone, Adrian checked the notes after the Devlin's name. Birthday. Dessert candle. No chocolate. Nowhere. Nowhere did it say surprise. And yet that was clearly what it was. Adrian had single-handedly ruined the woman's birthday surprise. Mr. Devlin was appropriately gruff.
Thanks a lot, he said.
The next 3 phone calls were easy. Adrian left clear, concise messages on voicemail for the guests who were out swimming or golfing or shopping from the Bartlett's farm truck on Main Street. Adrian called the White Elephant and confirmed for those guests. She called Mac Peterson at the beach club, who was also on her short list of potential dates, but he showed no special interest in the fact that it was Adrian calling rather than Thatcher. He was all business.
We have a guest who thinks she may have left her sunglasses there last night, he said. I guess they're Chanel glasses and Trey Cher, last name Cerucci.
Adrian checked the shelf inside the podium.
I don't see them here, she said.
She scanned the book from the night before to see if Thatcher had written a note about sunglasses. Well, she said, the Cerucci's sat down last night at 9:15. What are the chances that Mrs. Cerucci was wearing her sunglasses at 9:15?
Oh, Adrian, Max said wearily. You just don't understand the people I deal with all day.
Adrian glanced at the disheveled dining room. The cleaning crew hasn't been here yet, she said. I'll call you if we find anything.
Thank you,
Max said, and he hung up. Adrian wrote herself a note, sunglasses, while she dialed the parish's number. Darla picked up.
Hello?
Good morning, Darla. It's Adrian from the Blue Bistro.
Oh, you sweetheart.
Just calling to confirm two people at 6 tonight, Adrian said. There was a long pause on the other end.
Oh, God, Adrian thought.
What now?
We have Wolfie, Darla said.
I'm sorry?
We have Wolfie, our grandson, for the next 2 weeks. I told Thatcher this. To change the next 2 weeks of reservations to include Wolfie, I told him. Oh, wait. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I'm thinking of that darling Mateo at the boarding house. We eat there every Wednesday. Sorry. The next 4 reservations will be a party of 3 because of Wolfie. He's 6 years old. And here's the thing. He's a picky eater.
Okay, Adrian said. Next to the parish's name, she erased 2 and penciled in 3 with an asterisk next to the 3 that said, Wolfie, picky eater.
A very picky eater.
Adrian remembered babysitting for Mavis's twins. Graham would eat anything she put in front of him, but Coleman, the one who could hear, would only eat mayonnaise sandwiches.
What does he eat? Adrian asked.
I can make a note for the kitchen.
He likes Fruit Loops, Darla said, and a certain kind of yogurt that is bright pink and has a dinosaur on the package.
Is that it? Adrian asked. She was pretty sure cereal and children's yogurt weren't going to come out of the kitchen, even for the parishes.
Does he eat French fries?
Darla laughed.
Of course, I'm almost certain. Let's just get him French fries then. Will you write it down?
I'm writing it down, Adrian said.
It's just, well, he lives with his mother.
Say no more, Adrian said, as if she understood what that was supposed to mean, though really, she didn't want to hear it. She liked Darla and wanted to keep it that way. We'll see you at 6. At 11:30, Antonio, the sous chef, brought Adrian her lunch. She was on the phone with Mrs. Lefroy. Otherwise, she would have kissed the man. The plate looked gorgeous. As soon as Adrian hung up, she poked her head into the kitchen to say, "Thank you. Gracias. Thank you." Antonio waved. Adrian sat at a table in the bar and dug in. This was Antonio's interpretation of anything. Succulent black olives, sun-dried tomatoes, and marinated artichokes. 3 kinds of salami. Tiny balls of fresh mozzarella. Roasted cherry tomatoes. Some kind of creamy eggplant dip that made her swoon, and a basket of warm focaccia. Miraculously, the phone stayed quiet while she ate. She had 2 calls remaining, and she was done. She finished her lunch, took her plate into the kitchen, and returned to the podium to make the phone calls. 1 to the Walwinette Inn, 1 to the message machine of a beauty salon. The woman who cut Thatcher's hair was coming in at 9. Then, just as Adrian took her first longing look at the beach, Thatcher's truck pulled into the parking lot. Adrian greeted him, smiling widely. It had been a good morning.
You have something in your teeth, he said. She bolted for the ladies' room. Sure enough, tomato skin.
My worst nightmare, she said when she emerged. With my father and all.
How did the calls go?
Fine, she said. I ruined Jennifer Devlin's birthday. You didn't tell me it was a surprise.
Oops, he said.
The parishes are bringing their grandson.
He winced. Is it that time of year already? He said. What does he eat these days?
French fries. Darla said French fries. Thatcher shook his head.
We served him French fries last year. He fed them to the seagulls. She's forgotten.
There's a list of people for you to call back. A man named Leon Cross called on the private line to say it was urgent and top secret.
It's always urgent and top secret with Leon, Thatcher said. Anything else?
I had a delicious lunch.
Good. Fiona made it for you?
Antonio, I think.
Okay,
Thatcher said. Adrian thought he looked pale and a little distracted, but she was not going to ask him about the priest.
Can I go?
She asked.
Wait, he said. I have something for you.
He held up a white shopping bag.
Here.
Now Adrian was nervous. She peeked in the bag.
Clothes?
She pulled out a blue dress made of washed silk that was so soft it felt like skin.
Size 6.
There was another dress in a champagne color, the same cut, very simple, a slip dress to just above the knee. There was a third outfit, a tank and skirt in the same silk, bottle green.
These are for me? Let's see how they look.
She took the bag into the ladies' room and slipped the blue dress on over her bikini. It fell over Adrian's body like a dress in a dream. And it would look even better when she had the right underwear. So, here was her look. She checked the side of the shopping bag. The clothes had come from a store called Dessert on India Street, and Adrian recognized the name of the store as the one owned by the chef's wife, the redhead who had been so kind during soft opening. If you come in, I'd love to dress you free of charge. So maybe Thatch didn't pay for these clothes. Still, it was weird. Weird that Thatcher had told her she needed a look. Weird that he, or the redhead, had perfectly identified it. And weird that she now had to model it for him, proving him right. She stepped out into the dining room. He gazed at her, and then he gave a long, low whistle. That did it. Her face heated up. The skin on her arms tingled. She had never felt so desirable in all her life.
Tomorrow's your night off, he said.
She nodded. Wednesday was her night off. Last Wednesday, because everyone she knew on the island worked at the restaurant, she stayed home, ate frozen ravioli, and watched a rerun of The West Wing.
I scheduled myself off, too, he said. I want to take you out for dinner.
This stunned her so much she may have actually gasped.
Who's going to work? She asked. Karen, he said. She loves to do it, and we only have 70 on the book.
Adrian ran her hands down the sides of her new dress. The silk was irresistible.
Will you go out with me?
He asked. Rule 3. Exercise good judgment about men. Dating her boss did not seem wise. It seemed dangerous. More dangerous than getting entangled with Mario. And yet, she wanted to go.
Rules, after all, were made to be...
Sure, she said. When Adrian saw Thatcher at work that night, she thought things would be different between them. But Thatcher was preoccupied by the Lefroy's reservation. It wasn't a health inspector visit, but he wanted the restaurant to be clean. He wanted it to sparkle. And so, when Adrian arrived, expecting compliments on the new champagne-colored dress, he set her to work polishing glasses and buffing the silver with the servers. At the menu meeting, he demonstrated the way he wanted the busboys to use the crummers, and they were short a busboy since Tyler would be eating tonight with his parents. The staff ate family meal on the beach, and Thatcher made them brush every grain of sand from their person and wash their feet in a bucket before they were allowed back in the restaurant. As if that wasn't bad enough, Thatcher assigned Adrian to the parishes during first seating.
I want you to really watch them, he said. Anticipate their needs, especially Wolf's.
It sounds like you're asking me to babysit, Adrian said.
We're going to do what it takes to give Darla and Grayson some peace, Thatcher said. We want them to enjoy their meal, yes or no?
The parishes arrived 15 minutes late, which was unheard of, and what this meant was that instead of getting them squared away early on, they were smushed at the entrance with 3 other parties who needed to be seated, and 2 gorgeous blonde women who showed up without a reservation.
Adrian directed the Swedish bikini duo to the bar, sat the Devlins at table 25, and led a deuce staying at the White Elephant under the awning. Then she returned to the podium to properly greet the parishes. "Sorry," Adrian said. Grayson held up a palm.
"It's our fault," he said. "We had a little trouble getting out of the house."
Darla was holding a little boy's hand.
"This is Wolfie," Darla said.
Wolf had white blonde hair and eyes that were mottled and puffy. His breathing was hiccupy. Adrian crouched down. Despite her years of babysitting the twins, she did not consider herself someone who was good with children, and yet now she wanted to succeed, if only to impress Thatcher. "Hi, Wolf," she said. "My name is Adrian." He harrumphed and locked his arms over his chest. Darla smiled at him with all the love in the world, then whispered to Adrian,
"He's not having a good night."
Adrian led the parishes to table 20, and Bruno appeared seconds later with their drinks. Adrian pulled Bruno off to the side. "Order a frite pronto," she said. "Wolfie's not having a good night, and Thatcher wants Mr. and Mrs. P to be able to eat in their accustomed silence."
"Bitchy,"
Bruno said. He paused. "Is that a new dress?"
"Yes," Adrian said. "Thank you for noticing."
Karen approached Adrian with a stone face.
"I'm going to kill you."
"Why?"
"You put those girls at the bar."
"What girls?" Adrian checked the bar.
"Ah, yes. The girls."
They were laughing and flashing Duncan with their remarkable cleavage. Adrian instantly understood the problem, but come on. She was busy, and they were all adults here. Well, everyone except for Wolfie.
"They didn't have a reservation," Adrian said. "You could have put them at 3.
"I guess I could have, but they're all over him," Karen said.
"And he's just eating it up. Oh, and look, they ordered apple martinis. What an insipid drink."
"Okay, well, I'm sorry. I have to put a..." Thatcher passed by, touching Adrian's arm. He raised one pale eyebrow.
"I have to put a VIP order in," Adrian said to Karen.
"Champagne," Thatcher said.
"I'll get your champagne," Karen said. "Let me get it."
She strode toward the bar. Bruno breezed by with a huge plate of fries.
"These are for Dennis the Menace," he said. "You want to deliver?"
"I have to put their VIP order in," Adrian said.
"Already done," Bruno said.
He handed Adrian the plate of fries.
"You go, girl."
The parishes were sitting in silence. The elder two focused on their drinks, while Wolf lay splayed across the wicker chair, his face sullen.
"Fries," Adrian said brightly.
She took the seat next to Wolfie, but he couldn't be convinced to eat even one. She tried to lead by example, eating one fry, then another.
"You don't know what you're missing," she said.
"Please, Wolfie," Darla said. "Just try one. Just one for Gam. Please. I want yogurt," he said.
Grayson finished his Stoli tonic and flagged Bruno for another.
"Why don't you take Wolf down to the water, Adrian?"
"To the water?" Adrian said. She considered informing Grayson Parrish that she had work to do. The restaurant was buzzing around her. Thatcher sat tables, Elliot and Joe recited specials, Gage and Roy poured water and delivered donuts. Rex played Happy Birthday as Spillman popped a bottle of champagne for the Devlins. Adrian wanted to get up and join the adult activity. Bruno came to her rescue. He eased up alongside Adrian as she served apps to the adjoining table and whispered,